Yes.
Hello and welcome to the PC Gamer Podcast, episode 150 for September 25th, 2008. Today we'll cast pods about the end of Ensemble Studios, PC NPDs, why buy the nuke when you can get Fallout for free, and our least favorite game enemies. All this and more on the other side of these steel drums. I'm your podcast host, Evan Lotte, and I'm joined by Editor-in-Chief, Kristen Salvatore.
Hello.
And by former PCG EIC, Gary Witta.
Hello.
Also by esteemed podcast producer, Andy Bauman.
Hey, what's up, guys?
And the always lovable Andy Salisbury.
That's me.
I think I had the most sultry of the hellos there.
For sure. We'll leave that to our listeners to decide.
Post in the comments, folks. What'd you feel about it?
No.
So how's Thursday treating everybody in general?
I had a doctor's appointment this morning. That was
awesome.
Fun.
Awesome. Yeah. Still alive. That's good.
Yeah, I can got a big bandage on my arm.
Why did they take blood from you?
Yeah.
How much blood did they take from you?
I don't know, but they had to give me a lot of orange juice. No, I'm kidding. Not that much. A couple little vials.
Well,
enough to clone me.
Oh, because that's what we need is more Andy Salisbury's.
Doesn't everybody?
Totally. Come on. We need an intern very badly,
yeah,
actually.
Seriously. So. Yeah, what else is going on? The fish in my fish tank has grown to an extraordinary size. Like, I think I might have to get a new fish tank.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, I think he's too big.
You named him?
Sure.
No, we stopped naming the fish here after they started dying.
After they got eaten by the other ones.
You don't want to get too attached.
We find it better to just call them suckerfish, catfish, and zebrafish.
Seems reasonable. Yeah. All right, so we had the second of our third Showdown in LAN events in San Mateo, California last weekend. Me, Andy, and Andy were there. We did a live podcast. You guys, it's already posted on the website, on our podcast website, if you haven't listened to it already. And I guess, you know, it was a wonderful time. There were probably about 400 people that showed up or more. Got to meet some of our fantastic readers. We got to a live podcast, like I just said, and answer some great questions. That was a new experience for me. That was really fun. And, of course, got to play a lot of games with people, like very skilled TF2 players, and get annihilated by them. But it was really fun.
Yeah.
We met one reader in particular that was really me, Andy, and Andy. We had the opportunity to meet him on Friday night. He's just this extremely nice guy. His name is Scott Haynes.
Hines, I believe.
Hines? Okay, sorry.
Scott.
Yeah, he's
Scott,
wonderful.
This is for you.
And he actually posted some pictures on which thread was it? I think the podcast 149. Yeah, in the comments thread, he posted like a gallery of like 100 pictures from the event. If you guys are curious,
I'll repost. I'll dig it up and I'll put it in the show notes.
Great. Yeah, it was a blast.
I'm actually leaving at noon tomorrow to head to Peoria for that event.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And
on.
I think there's like,
hello, Peoria.
There's like 600 people registered for that already. So.
Oh wow!
Yeah.
So that'll be even bigger than the one. It's here.
It's
there.
Gonna be gigantic.
Having Scott recognize who we were gave me chills. I was like, oh crazy! Like I didn't expect that. And then we were just playing TF2 in that tournament. We had a really good time playing with, like, it was me, Will, Andy, Evan, and my buddy who came out with me, Clint. And man, we thought we were hot shit until we got our asses handed to us.
You got swamped.
Yeah.
Yeah,
we like won the first round, and we were like, "Yes, guys, we're bringing it back." And then just like we go straight to the losers bracket, and then we lose in the losers bracket.
Yeah,
that was tough.
It was. I mean, it was rough. I mean, I feel okay because some of the people there had played like 600 plus hours just as one class.
Wow.
Like, yeah, the guy sitting next to me.
Mm-hmm. Team F10, I think.
Yeah, F10. I didn't get his name. He had played Soldier for so long, and I was watching him play in the finals, and like the way he would rocket jump blew me away. Like, he could just twitch and he would rocket jump wherever he needed to go, and like I was trying to practice that later on, and I was just like, oh my goodness, that guy had timing like a mofo.
I mean, that's the equivalent of like 26 days played as just one class. I can't imagine that, but
yeah, he's my hero pretty much.
I need to wear like a fake cast on my arms that people don't play
so they don't challenge you to games. Yeah, it's like,
yeah.
Yeah, there was actually...
Didn't you guys do a little contest where you, Norm, and Will like had arena battles.
Yeah, it was really fun. We did like a Max PC, PC Gamer Editors versus the World little impromptu event. And it was like me, Will, and Norm, and we played in arena mode on TF2, which is sort of a very small map, very tight. And we took on like all comers and stuff, and we went undefeated somehow.
Wow.
Norm was playing really well. He shot a scout out of midair with a rocket, which was like
that's
beautiful.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it was really fun.
Hey, what about really did you guys do a case mod contest?
Yeah, this guy who had a spinner, like a from a tire as his fan.
Like a legit spinner.
Yeah, he had he was riding spinners
like,
on his case.
It was like a legitimate rim, almost like a fan on the outside of his case. It's like very, very vertical red case. It's beautiful. You can. It's actually in.
I think there's a pick on.
Yeah, in Scott's. You took like three of them. Yeah. It's beautiful.
Wow.
Yeah.
It made me want to get into case modding so much.
That's.
But then I remembered how lazy I am.
Those are. It's really the ones that are amazing like that are very time intensive.
For sure.
People have a lot of, like, I remember some of the ones that we saw at San Mateo or in San Jose last year were, you know, just amazing, like etched lucite, like things that were so time consuming and really required a lot of not just technical skill to sort of make everything fit and work, but artistic skill as well. So I'm actually really looking forward to that this weekend. Although I guess I'll be judging it on my own. I think I'm the only one who's going to be there.
Oh, is Will going still?
Will's not going to go. No.
Oh, shucks.
Mm. It's Genius a lot ticket. Of responsibility.
No. Unless you want to.
All right, so other than Showdown, which was a blast, you know, I really hope we're able to do it again next year. That's actually what somebody asked us. I wasn't really able to give them a straight answer, but...
If I had to guess, I would imagine we'll be doing them next year. I mean, that's not... We don't really run them. It's actually our events department that runs them, so it's kind of up to them. But I would sure hope and think that we would.
Yeah, definitely. So I mentioned in the live podcast, actually, and the one before that, I think, that Ensemble Studios, unfortunately, was closed last week by Microsoft.
Ooh.
And we're sorry to be the bringer of bad news and the reflector of bad news again, but it's such an injustice to the developers' effort and their history that the last game they're ever going to make is Halo Wars, you know, a console-only spin-off RTS. It's such a disservice to Age of Empires series and all their effort. And I mean, there haven't been any layoffs yet. Microsoft is assisting in helping the staff find new positions, either internally or externally, I guess. But I guess that the studio's head, Bruce Shelley, was, quote, shocked and very disappointed that it happened. To quote him, he said that, "I believe we thought we were immune to shutdown talk because our published games have done so well and have been so profitable. Plus, we felt we had a really stable, talented, hardworking, creative team, which is not easy to do. We thought we were among the best studios in the world, and that may be true, but we don't fit in the future plans of Microsoft Game Studios as an internal studio, so we're out." So it sounded to them like he was pretty blindsided by the whole thing. I looked up the sales of Age of Empires 3, and apparently sold 2 million copies, which is great on the PC, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great on any platform.
Yeah. And sort of in response, Shane Kims, who's the corporate VP for Microsoft, he continued to say that it was a long-term business decision, whatever that means. Apparently, some of the heads of Ensemble are going off to make an independent studio, which was one of my hopes that they would, you know, go out and so they'd be able to actually make games that they want. Because they're also allegedly there was a story that they were working on a Halo MMO.
Yeah, actually, I'm looking through the Flickr album of all the mock-ups right now.
Yeah, there's a lot of concept art out there for it. And
because you can just slap MMO at the end of any game and you'll have a hit on your hands.
I'm just... I don't understand. I mean, I have a lot of confidence in Ensemble. I think they make great games, but why would you put that developer on an MMO project? You know, for that IP, it's just bizarre. I don't know.
Why would you? Oh well, yeah.
Yeah, it was canceled apparently.
I think it's pretty clear how I feel about this.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I interviewed kind of on the fly. Interviewed Shane Kim just before E3 this year. He was at a pre-E3 event and I like wandered my way into a group of, he was talking to a bunch of journalists about consoles specifically. And I asked him like, what's the percentage of PC to console games that MGS is going to be focusing on in the next year? And it was something like 80-20. And I asked him flat out, like, what's the deal? You know, how can you possibly be the champion of the PC platform when you don't put out any first party games? Like, what, you know, why you don't seem to be focusing on the PC at all? And he frankly didn't really have an answer for me. And so it's a little disappointing. On one hand, I'm happy to see that he's willing to go on the record and say, yeah, the PC is still really important to us. But, man, I'd really like to see the other, you know, the continuation of that conversation with some examples of how it's important to them and what they're going to be doing to support the platform.
I mean, that's really what we're lacking, some specifics on their part in terms of the long-term plan that he's mentioning. I mean, if you're offing one of your profitable, you know, PC gems, I don't understand how it's in their long-term interest to continue, you know, putting out first-party games on the PC, which is what Shane Kim said that they're going to continue to do. So
it's frustrating.
Man,
absolutely.
Maybe someone at Microsoft just felt like the English longbowmen were way OP in Age of Empires 2. held that grudge for years to come.
I guess so. So that's the bad news, I guess. But otherwise, there's some good news coming up this week. Fans of the GameTap service may be wondering about its status since Turner laid off its editorial department earlier this year. Well, they'll be relieved to know that Metaboli, which is a sort of a UK European version of the service, so actually one of their competitors, they're going to pick up the management rights to the service. And Turner's going to remain the significant investor, I guess, in GameTap. But there's, I guess, the users are going to see, quote, no interruption of their service. And additionally, we learned today that actually, as convenient as it was to get Fallout off good old games for just $6, and we were very happy with that, that GameTap's releasing Fallout for free. It's available today.
Who here uses GameTap?
I don't, actually.
Anybody?
Am I the only one? Yeah, this might be not a good crew to be discussing GameTap's fate, but yeah, I don't use it.
I actually have really liked it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's been a great way to get access to a bunch of older games that I either, you know, don't have anymore or that are hard to find. And like, I've really enjoyed using it as a way to take little walks down memory lane and to just like fill in the gaps in my PC gaming experience. So I actually really liked it.
Definitely. I mean, at this stage, like from a big picture perspective, I think the more digital delivery services we have, the better like competition between Steam and Impulse and Games for Windows and whoever else. I mean, that's good for us, the end users, right? I mean,
sure.
At this stage when everybody's still integrating new features and figuring out DRM business, and it can only be a good thing for people to have more options. So it's good news that they're being picked up, I guess.
I think so. The only statement the guy from the European service made was that this will give us a foothold in the US market. Or that's the only statement that Edge Online posted. And that's kind of like is that a good thing, or I don't know what to read into that.
I'm trying to see who's investing in whom here. I guess it's that Turner is actually investing in Metaboli, but was it Metaboli?
Yeah, it wasn't like an outright acquisition. It's basically right. Like Metaboli sort of they are purchasing it, but Turner's remaining like a big investor in the service in GameTap. So, it's still kind of mind-boggling to me that Turner wouldn't hold on to that property by itself because, I mean, they have all the ways to advertise it. They have Cartoon Network and their TV networks. They have outdoor advertising.
Right. Oh, yeah, look at who else. Metaboli also works with Ubisoft, Atari, and Nidos.
Mm.
So, I mean, you know, maybe they think by creating a global entity, they'll be closer to being able to compete with Steam, concerning that Steam's got like 15 million worldwide subscribers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, do you think it'll become something of a more modern game distribution system? Because, I mean, GameTap, as it stands now, Kristen, isn't it more like classic games that sort of missed the mainstream eye?
There is some newer stuff, but that's been my experience with it. But, you know, I mean, really the only thing that stops any digital distribution service from... It's just a matter of like what third parties are willing to put their titles on there and how the money works out between them. So Ubisoft, mm-hmm. I think, is a good example. Like I have been sort of watching, and they really are playing the field among all of the digital distribution services. So they've got stuff on Steam, they've got stuff on Direct to Drive, they obviously have stuff on Metaboli. Like they're really sort of putting their stuff everywhere, which I think is pretty interesting. that they're, you know, it seems to me that their theory is, hey, let's just make it as available to everybody as possible. Yeah. So
gamers win, I guess.
Gamers win. Yeah, I'd be curious, and it's not like we can get that information from Ubisoft. They don't hand it out, but I'd be curious to know what sort of how all of those deals work. You know, like obviously they have to. I imagine they have to pay a percentage to each of those services,
right?
In exchange for having their stuff up there. But you know, obviously whatever the numbers are, they work out well enough. You know, I guess there's certainly sense in like, oh, let's make it available more places so that we get more sales to offset the cost of putting it on the services. So,
you know, I wonder if Games Tap, if this will affect, because I know they already stopped being like the producers or whatever on the Sam & Max series, but they sort of have partnerships with, you know, Sam & Max and the Grimm Tales.
Right.
And so I wonder if this is going to affect future, you know, partnerships with games in order to like get them out a little bit early on Games Tap for the subscribers and stuff like that.
Or maybe it'll just make them more available.
Or maybe it'll make them better that way. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's fine by me.
We shall see.
Yeah.
And also in the non-digital arena of PC game sales, we got word this week of the PC NPDs at retailers. And Spore accounts for 3 of the 10 top 10 listings of games sold in August.
Sold a million copies already.
Indeed. Yeah, number one was the standard edition of Spore. Number two was the Galactic Special Edition. And number four was the Creature Creator.
Gaz, are you there?
I am here.
Have you played Spore?
I've been listening intently.
Have you played Spore?
I have not played Spore because nobody has deemed to send me a free copy. And I haven't heard enough good things about it to go out and buy it on my own. So I'm kind of in a holding pattern on Spore.
Got it. I'm curious to see what you think of it. Because I know you really liked The Sims, if I recall.
I did really like The Sims, but I don't... apart from the fact that it's from the same creator, I don't understand why... Yeah, I don't understand why if I liked The Sims, I would like this, because they seem to be very, very different games.
I was going to say, the only reason that I bring up the fact that you appreciated The Sims is that I think, similar to The Sims, you have to be able to appreciate that it's a different kind of game than the kind of game a hardcore gamer usually plays. That's more of like a toy kind of diversion. And the fact that you could appreciate that in The Sims makes me think you could maybe appreciate it in Spore.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it looks like fun. I just, it's been a long time since I had to pay money for a PC game. So I've always been able to finagle one through various means. But as I slip further and further off the PC gaming radar in terms of relevance, do you know it's been nearly 10 years since I edited PC Gamer? It's a
You're
long
too busy
time.
Being a movie star,
I'm too busy doing other things. But it means that I don't have the same luxury contacts that I used to have in the world of PC gaming. It could be that I would just call up EA and say, "Hey, send me a copy." But I don't know anyone at EA anymore. It's
we can barely
sad.
Even do that.
I know. And so, what chance do I have? So I guess I could go buy it. But like again, had all the reviews justified all the high. I know you guys gave it a very good review, but other places were not quite so kind to it. So it's a little bit mixed. I'm like, I don't know, I kind of needed to feel like it was more of a critical home run before I went out and got it.
You actually spend your money.
Yeah.
Yeah, it definitely, we won't get too much into it. I'm sure you guys talked about it on the last couple podcasts. It's definitely one of those games that people are either sort of get and like or just don't, or it's just not for them. Like, it's really not the sort of game to play if you're like moderately interested in it, because you won't like it. You have to sort of, I mean, that was actually the thing I like about the variety of the reviews, is I think people have done a pretty good job of explaining why they do or don't like it. And it's exactly what I suspected it would be. People who are like, oh yeah, this is, you know, they can kind of appreciate the toy aspect, have fun with it. And people who don't like that in a game, it's not for them. So.
Speaking of, I mean, I guess now that we're on the topic of Spore, they did just sort of, you know, back off on the DRM a lot, which is news.
That whole, what a nightmare for them.
Yeah, I mean, if they had just done this in the first place, it wouldn't have been an issue.
Yeah, as we were, you know, I think I mentioned on a previous podcast even, like, it's a complicated situation. EA is a public company and, you know, they can't. There's no way, like, if it was, there's no way that the game could get pirated and then they could go to their shareholders and be like, and we didn't put any DRM on it. Like, they'd just be throttled. it's just made sort of doubly worse by the fact that, like, I don't know, they're sort of getting it from all sides.
Yeah.
It's a no-win situation, I think.
Indeed. I mean, it's nice that they're showing some flexibility, but, I mean, with a game like that, you'd think they'd have the foresight to maybe do, I guess, market research on how people would respond.
Something, yeah.
Yeah.
Can you imagine how defeated they must feel against, like, the Amazon crowd that gave them all the bad reviews? Go, like,
or just, like,
validate
how
their
awful it yeah. must feel to see your game, like, cracked before it even gets released. Like,
definitely.
Yeah, like, how... And, you know, like, I know those... You know, we all know those guys pretty well. Like, I don't think anybody was like, yeah, a DRM solution. Like, that's going to be the perfect thing. Like, I think everybody's, most developers that I've run into are keenly aware of all of the reasons that we bring up not liking DRM solutions, you know, namely that they don't work.
Mm-hmm.
But what are you going to do? You can't do nothing.
Indeed. Well, and speaking of things that we do not like, I'd pose a topic to our podcasteteers today that they think of a game enemy that they either really enjoy fighting against or really just irritates the hell out of them. And they came up with, well, I'm not sure yet, actually, so that's what we're going to talk about. Andy Salisbury, did you have one in mind that just some enemy in a shooter, an RTS that really just gets to you or you love to fight against?
I actually was a big fan. I love the fact that he was such a big player in the game of Marathon, the bad guy Durandal, because essentially mm-hmm. you're just his puppet throughout the entire game, and there's nothing you can do about it but follow what he tells you to do, because he's creating like civilizations to go at war with each other, and he's basically counting on you or forcing you to sneak through and do all this really shady, mean stuff, and it's really cool. And so
I'm trying to remember. Is it kind of like a BioShock situation?
Almost, yeah. Actually, okay. I could probably fall in line with that. And then Sephiroth from Final Fantasy VII. Like, I know it's so easy to say, but he was just a really good villain. Like, you hated that dude so much.
Did you cry?
Big sword.
I got upset. I mean, you know, spoiler alert, but I got really, really upset when he killed Aeris, man. Like, I was like, it's like, dude, why would you... Oh, she didn't do anything to you, man. She was just a flower girl, and she was praying, and I cannot believe you're so heartless. I just wanted to do a limit break on him. Awesome. That's all I wanted. I was like, oh, you bastard. I'm going to Omni-slash the shit out of you.
And you did. And you did.
I did.
All right.
Good.
Andy Bauman, how about yourself?
I don't know. I'm, like, feverishly trying to think of something good to say. Although, that's I guess fine. One enemy of gaming... who got disbarred today is Jack Thompson. Or
there you go.
So yes. Maybe that does that count as an enemy that we all defeated that's together?
Yes.
As a global community?
The biggest co-op round ever. Totally.
Ooh, yeah.
And I like co-op.
Other than that...
sad little Jack.
I don't know. Come back. I'll interrupt.
Yeah. No problem.
Keep rounding.
Yeah. Gary, did you have a chance to think of one, possibly?
I can think of two fairly recent examples of one that I really liked and one that I didn't like. The one that I didn't like was from BioShock, but mainly because the rest of the game had set such a high standard for being a different kind of first-person shooter and a different kind of experience that, you know, when you got to the final boss and, you know, the story and everything that you've been so invested in had got to this point where you were like, oh, my God, we're at the end, and now what's going to happen? That the final boss was just felt very generic to me.
Absolutely.
And I know this is a problem that a lot of other people had as well, where it was just a kind of a very... I had expected, based on everything else that the game had done, for it to offer a different kind of boss experience. But it was just another one of those typical big, rawr guys stomping around and hurling stuff at you, and you had to kind of shoot him until he died. And that just felt very bland to me. I don't know if they ran out of enthusiasm or something at the end, but that was a letdown. In contrast, the my favorite boss recently is from Portal, which was kind of everything that I felt the BioShock boss should have been, which was it was a different kind of boss experience there. It wasn't just about, you know, a boss shooting stuff at you and you avoiding him and finding his weak spot. There was a cool puzzle element to it. And, of course, you know, you had the whole story element of GLaDOS continuing to kind of go insane and hurl various different insults and things trying to undermine you as you were getting closer and closer to destroying her. I thought that was a really cleverly designed boss, and I think it really highlighted, because both games came out around the same time, just how pedestrian BioShock's boss was in comparison to the rest of the game.
Definitely. I mean, that's a great way of putting it. I mean, even though the boss at the end of Portal was... excuse me. Yeah.
Everybody knows, I think, by now. Okay. I'm pretty sure the secret's out. Yeah.
Yeah, I would hope so. But,
that was awesome.
Even though it was very mechanically different from... I mean, you weren't really... You were using your portals, but it was more about just, like, hearing what GLaDOS had to say and, like, dismantling her and just having that process. And it was sort of cathartic because, you know, she'd been messing with you for so long. But even though it was mechanically different, it was very interesting. I mean, but yeah, I mean, BioShock for me was such a letdown. It was such a sour note to end the game on. I mean, even the room you're in was so small, so confining, not interesting.
Yeah, and you know, and it had continued to offer new types of experiences and keep you guessing all the way to the end, like the sequence towards the end where you become a big daddy. Like, that changed the style of the game, and it was something that you probably didn't expect to do, and it became about protecting the little sisters and a very different movement mechanic with the big daddy and collecting the suit, and you got to be the, you know, one of these things that had, you know, been so scary to you throughout the game. This was all really original. So when you finally get to the boss, which, you know, you think of as one of the biggest parts of a game, you know, the final climax, you know, it's just like at the end of a movie. If the ending's not satisfying, then it kind of puts the mockers on everything that's gone before. And so I really had, I don't know if they ran out of time or whatever, it seemed like they ran out of originality right before they got to designing the boss, because it felt very much like every other boss that I've played against.
For sure. I remember Ken Levine or one of the producers admitting that, you know, the end half or third or quarter or whatever the game was just, you know, kind of a rush job, I guess, and that would be pretty good evidence toward it. I mean, yeah, I mean, you compare that to, like, the Sander Cohen sequence and how well-presented and thoughtful and, like, emotionally, you know, it just bothered you. It was interesting. So, yeah, that's a great way of putting it.
I'd kind of like to see a game that did something really kind of gutsy and did almost like a Coen Brothers ending where, you know, you think there's going to be a big boss at the end, but it actually ends up to be kind of really anticlimactic. Like, you get to the end of the game and the boss has already been killed. I'd like to see what gamers would make of that, because, you know, you remember at the end of No Country for Old Men, everyone was like so unsatisfied by the ending, even though it's true to the ending of the book. People have been so conditioned by Hollywood endings to expect some kind of big shootout, and the movie plays into that expectation. You know, you're being set up to expect the cliche, and when the movie subverts the cliche, you're kind of like, what the hell happened? That's not how it's supposed to go. And so I'd kind of like to see a game try to do something like that, just to kind of, you know, subvert what has become a very, very heavily compounded expectation in gamers' minds that, you know, games always end with some kind of titanic special stage battle against the boss. You know, do something different.
And actually, that makes me curious, like, just real quickly to pull away from our topic. Are there certain things in particular that you feel like is the gaming industry copying from the movie industry too much? Should there be more of that? What do they have to learn from the movie industry in terms of just producing games, telling stories? I mean,
I don't think they're necessarily copying, and I don't know how much there really is to learn, because, you know, they are ultimately different kinds of experiences. I just think that, you know, technically, or in terms of the artistry, gaming is still very much in its infancy compared to movie making. Like, if you think about, you know, movies 40 or 50 years ago, you know, almost all the movies that came out of that kind of golden age of Hollywood had a very, very, you know, if there was a good guy and a bad guy, they would end in a very typical way. And that was true of Hollywood movies almost entirely through, you know, the 80s and 90s. It's only recently now that you see things like No Country for Old Men, where, you know, they try to do something more interesting. Like, okay, well, let's not give the audience exactly what they expect and see how they deal with it. I don't think gaming is there yet. Gaming is still very much in the business of giving the audience what they think they expect. But the result is, you know, usually when you get what you expect, it's not very exciting. There's no shock to the system there. And so you go, okay, here's a boss. And that's exactly how it was with BioShock to me. So, okay, well, here's the boss. Pretty much what I expected. Better beat the boss now, and that's not exciting. And I'm not saying that you can that just having the absence of a boss or really kind of, you know, screwing with the gamer's heads and going, ah, oh, you got here and the boss is already dead. Like, that may be too clever for its own good. I'm just looking for something that may, you know, just offer something different from the expectation. And that's what's kind of cool about it, is that when you've got an expectation that's built up in the audience by, you know, decades of cliched endings, you can use that to your advantage and do something that, that plays into the audience expectation and then does the opposite thing and kind of throws the gamer for a loop. So I don't know exactly what the design solution to that is. I wouldn't know how to implement that into the end of a game, but I think the spirit of that is a good idea, and I'd like to see designers try and do something different instead of just, you know, oh, here's the boss, here's his weak spot. Oh, his armor's fell off, now you get to do the next part, you know, shoot him in the nuts or whatever. Like, we've seen it 1,000 times, let's do something else.
Yeah, I mean, just in the same way that we're sort of shedding these other conventions like, you know, health bars and continues and whatnot, I mean, sort of people need to address those story conventions where there has to be an end boss, I guess, maybe. And, I mean, for me, it's always the... I mean, games like Bioshock and Mass Effect and KOTOR, you sort of have this binary situation where your character's alignment between good and evil and, like, the quantity of decisions that you make along that spectrum determines, you know, what cutscene you see, basically. I really want to see more middle ground, more gray area for endings. I guess, you know, Fallout's going to present some of that. Fallout 3 is going to present some of that with by sort of customizing the ending.
I really like the BioWare approach. I really like the Mass Effect, KOTOR type approach, where it forces you to live with the consequences of the decisions that you've made. There is, you know, there is more than one ending, and that also adds to the replayability as well, because people like to see both endings. When I played Mass Effect on my initial playthrough, I did the absolute hardcore, you know, be a complete bastard, make all the really dark side decisions all the way through, and it's fun for a while. But as you kind of live in the skin of that character more and more, you start to feel a little bit uncomfortable about it. And I like that the game had forces you to make that reaction at the end. You know, I chose not to save the senators and basically destroyed the existing government and installed myself as some kind of imperial. I did like the ultimate kind of dark side ending of that
game. It's a dream come true.
Yeah, well, it is, but it isn't. Like I said, it's kind of fun in theory, but when you actually find yourself playing it out, there's a discomfort to it, and you're like, oh, you know, this is really kind of bad.
I have tried to play all of those games, KOTOR and Mass Effect included. I've tried to replay them as dark side characters, and I can't do it. I just don't enjoy it.
There are some. I remember KOTOR did it better than Mass Effect did, actually. There were some, because again, on my initial playthrough of KOTOR, I did the dark side playthrough, and it was fun for a while. But there came to a point where there were a couple of missions, a couple of storyline subplots that the dark side solution to was so morally awful. Right. I just couldn't bring myself to do it. It was just absolutely terrible. Where you weren't even destroying lives for your own personal gain. You were doing it just because it amused you. And I think that is, I mean, obviously that's true to the idea of being an evil Sith character. I thought it was a little bit of a cop-out, actually, that towards the end it allowed you to kind of redeem, you know, even though no matter how far down the dark path you had gone, you could still redeem yourself in one, you know, there was always one final fork available at the end where you could completely become light side. And I guess that, I mean, I guess if Darth Vader can do it, you can too. But I just felt like it was a little bit of a cop-out, you know, it's like, you know, you can't, in real life, you can't really wipe the slate clean and suddenly become good after a lifetime of evil.
Isn't it funny how none of these games ever come up when people, you know, go on Fox News and bemoan the fact that video games are you know, allowing our, you know, are allowing, like, kids or whomever to make choices that are morally corrupt. Like, they never bring up this stuff.
No, I mean, what they would rather do is focus on games like GTA, which, you know, in all fairness, do, you know, put you in a position where, you know, all you're really able to, your only moral attitude is within a very dark area to begin with. It's like, well, you know, do I kill this person or let him live? Is, you know, but I'm basically, I still am stealing his money and stealing his car and doing all kinds of bad things. Whereas,
but to
I
me,
think
that's,
what,
that's more, that's actually more of a, that's actually a more of like a farce almost of the situation. You know what I mean? Like something more like Mass Effect or KOTOR where you really are kind of a neutral character and you have to choose which way to go. Like that to me carries more decision-making weight than something like GTA where your character is kind of a scumbag to begin with. Like,
I think it might be a research thing because, let's be honest, it's a lot easier to look at a game and see somebody shooting people then actually sit down and realize, oh, well, this is set in the Star Wars universe and I know what, you know, I know about the Sith, I know what's going on. Yeah, it's just easier to show people a screen where there's, you know, people's heads getting blown off.
And it's the dark side paths are really interesting because it's fantasy wish fulfillment for people, you know, who in real life have to behave normally. You ever do that thing where you're having like a conversation with someone, like a friend or whatever, or a business associate, and it's perfectly nice and pleasant, and you're, you know, talking along with them, but there's like the psychopathic 1% of your brain, the little voice at the back of your head's going, I wonder what would happen if I just smacked this person in the face right now, just to see what would happen. And you can't do that because you would have to live with the consequences of it. But in a game, you can do it with impunity, and so I think it's kind of fun for that reason.
Wouldn't it be funny if the guy you smacked started like acting like an NPC in a game, and he's just like, stop that.
I've always you know the Adam Sandler movie where he gets the magic remote control.
Yeah,
I never saw it. Yeah.
Fast forward and rewind time and blah blah blah. I've always thought that I wouldn't even need one that sophisticated. I would just need one that has one button that rewinds time like 10-15 seconds. So that, again, in the middle of a meeting or something, you go, "You're an idiot," and I wish you would die. And then like watch everyone's reactions and then press the button and it never happened. That would be awesome.
So basically, you want your life to be Braid.
Yeah, pretty much. I'd like to be able to braid my way through life.
Didn't you just Soulja Boy review Braid?
Yeah, Soulja Boy review it.
Wonderful. All right, well, that was a nice little tangent, guys.
What was your answer, Evan? Did we ever get one out of you?
No, we didn't get one from Kristen either.
Oh, right.
Mine were not nearly as interesting. In fact, mine definitely aren't as interesting. The enemy I sort of love to hate most are probably the head crabs in Half-Life.
That's a good one.
Yeah, because they're for especially the poisonous head crabs, so you know they're I don't know, it's they're a pain in the butt.
It's the way they pounce at you.
But it's also I love the way they I sort of love and equally hate the way they kind of come out of nowhere and mine was not really as interesting.
I mean, they always have those like little audio cues where they kind of like squeal before you see them, so you know they're in the vicinity, but you don't know where. Definitely, but
it's such a good feeling when you actually manage to just like pop one right out of the air because you manage to just like turn in time. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what the shotgun's good for.
Yeah,
yeah. Oh, Illidan in World of Warcraft, Illidan Stormrage and Arthas, both really, really good enemies.
Mm. How just so? I'm not familiar.
Just I don't know. They're just really, really sinister characters. Like everything they do is, you know, obviously very. I mean, if we're still on the Star Wars thing, maybe a little bit. It's very much on the Sith tangent because they just do stuff that is either to amuse them or because they just think it'll give them more power overall in the world, you know? I mean, I'm not sure if, you know, Gary, you know much about the lore.
No, because I stopped playing a little while ago. The last boss that I killed, and it was actually the most satisfying thing I've ever done in a video game, was Eye of C'thun or C'thun, whoever you pronounce it. And that was, tough. this is back in the days of 40 man encounters where you needed remarkable amounts of large team, teamwork and synchronization. And it was, you know, and it would, the thing is, once you wiped, you couldn't just go back and do the boss again. You'd have to wait a week probably to like go and get all the new potions and reagents. Yeah, you've got to work through all the trash. And also, you know, you need to buff up with a lot of potions and reagents and a lot of the ones that you used didn't persist through death. So once you died, you know, you would need another potion, and that would be a whole big deal. We wiped on it several times, but when we finally got it, because you had to be absolutely inch perfect. If even one person messed up, the whole raid wiped. There was a very, very low margin for error. But once we finally got it, and we were almost dead, and we finally got it, and when it went, I remember like literally kind of throwing up my hands and cheering. You could hear 39 other people all cheering in your headset as well. And it actually felt genuinely, that was like one of the best things I've ever done in my life. And I know that's tragic, but that's the...
No, I know what you mean, because when we finally were able to get Illidan Stormrage down, like I remember it was just like such an insanely good feeling to know that we had all... I mean, it's not quite 40-man raids, like when we first got Nefarian down and stuff. We never got quite to C'thun, but as we're pushing through Sunwell and stuff, it's just like, it's such a cool feeling when you know you can come together with all those other people and just like
this is the great thing
so
now
well.
Though, is that now they don't do 40-man raids. The players that have been around for a long time get to kind of be like the old crusty war veterans now, going, you kids don't know what it's like when we used to have to do 40-man raids. That was much tougher than what you kids deal with today.
I had to walk uphill both ways to them.
You had to ride your non-flying mount to it.
Fantastic. Yeah, and mine's actually also from Half-Life 2, Episode 2, the Hunters, that they sort of the big new enemy in that game.
Oh, those things are brutal.
I mean, yeah, when they're first introduced, they're sort of just, they seem like, oh, they're just very, these little, like, scoutier, very mobile versions of the walkers, sort of like their little brother or their little cousin. But as you go on, you keep encountering them, and they're just so persistent. They hunt in packs, and their little flechette gun, where they shoot it from afar, and the needles kind of stick into you, and they're there for a second, you're like, oh, and then they explode and damage you. That's really annoying. But just how dynamic they are. I mean, you sort of get into that situation near the end, you're like in this alpine house, and there's a big encounter. You sort of get ambushed, and you're inside with Alex, and you think you're kind of safe from them, but they come in from the ceiling, they come in from the basement. They're just very mobile, and I mean, they're also kind of one of my favorite enemies to fight at the same time, because they're very expressive too, I feel like. Like when if they see you, they'll sort of let out a coup to let their little comrades know to come ambush you and whatnot, or they'll whimper when you finally wound them or take one down. It's just, they're fun to fight. They're very mobile. They're very, you feel like you always have to strafe and outthink them, really. So, very memorable.
And Half-Life 2 is actually another example of a game that I think Valve, now that I think about it, between Half-Life 2, Episode 2, and Portal, have really kind of got probably more elevated thinking about quote-unquote boss battles than most other developers these days.
I would agree.
Because, you know, again, in Half-Life 2, it isn't a traditional boss battle. It's that really cool sequence where the walkers are advancing on the human base,
right?
And you have to kind of, you know, ride around in your truck from place to place and constantly replenishing your weapons, and there's waves of hunters as well to protect them. You got to take out those walkers as they're advancing with the with your rocket launcher. And it took me about 7 or 8 times to get it done, and each time that I did it, I remember my heart was just absolutely in my throat as I was racing around trying to take those things out. So I think, you know, that's what I like about Valve, is they're thinking about these encounters now less in the terms of, as I said, quote-unquote boss battles, and more just in terms of how can we make the climax of the game really exciting. It doesn't have to be about fighting one titanic enemy. There's other ways we can do it. And so, that, you know, they basically had a whole wave of walkers that you had to figure out how to beat in the time that you had before they advanced on the perimeter of the base. It was really, really tense.
But that's kind of how all of those games have been, that idea of the game being kind of a cinematic experience where there aren't loading screens. It's like you're moving through, almost through a movie. And to me, it's completely in keeping with how both of the, or all really, of the Half-Life games have been, that you, that yeah, the end is in fact this big cinematic experience.
This could so easily degenerate into a Half-Life love session. Because
I know.
Episode 2. I mean, I can't wait for... I don't know how long we're going to have to wait for Episode 3, but however long it is, it's too long. Because Episode 2 was... I mean, all of them, really. Half-Life 2 and Episode 1, and increasingly Episode 2, they just get better and better. I can't remember the time that I was so engrossed in the story and the world of a game. They just do it so well.
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, there was such... there's such good anticipation. The way they built it up for that last sequence where there's sort of the briefing with the other Resistance members. Dr. Magnuson's, you know, sort of very organically, it's like teaching you how to fire this new device at the walkers, and there's a new music sequence. I mean, they basically rolled out like a miniature open world environment and just kind of throw stuff at you and give you the tools to figure it out and deconstruct it. It's brilliant for sure.
When you hear Valve talk about it, either in the commentary or you're lucky enough to have a presentation from one of the developers or something, they talk about their play testing and their game decisions in terms of like movie terms. They say like pacing.
Right.
And all in terms like that, and you never really hear that from any other games, and they're really, really consciously developing for the pace of the game and the story. So it's like really cool to hear about that.
I read recently that I think it's still correct that when they're developing a game, they play test it every week, and the developer has to be in the room with, you know, someone from outside the company that's play testing it, and you know, just see them like be frustrated by different aspects of it. So it's a very constant thing that they're trying to be aware of that experience and not making sure people aren't stuck up on, you know, different elements of the game design and whatnot. So it's working out so far, that's for sure.
I just remember how cinematic of a feeling it was, like at the very end when and I don't want to ruin anything again, but you know, when Eli goes down, like I remember being really legitimately torn up about it.
Oh yeah,
because like he was such a pivotal character. Like he was so friendly, and there was nothing you couldn't like about this guy. And like he, you know, his daughter's really cool, and she's, you know, just a really strong woman and everything. And it's just really cool. You know,
can you imagine the fallout if they ever kill Alex?
You know what? It's a good question. Like I've wondered if they will. because they've now, like, they've done this miraculous thing and actually created a character that you give a crap about.
Yeah.
Like, she has been, you know, mm-hmm. they've managed to make your sidekick transcend the sidekick, you know.
Yeah, it's funny. I remember in episode 2, there's a couple of periods where she's gone for a long period, you know, where you go down separate paths. And then when you're finally reunited with her later in the game, it's like you're so glad to see her, like you missed
right.
her. Like, that's a pretty amazing achievement for a video game.
Yeah. So I'm kind of curious. I'm curious about a lot of things with regard to the future of that franchise. Like, what are they going to do after episode 3? But I'm very, very curious to see what happens to Alex.
It would be the biggest death since Eri.
It would be huge.
It would be.
But
big.
I actually
well,
think
it'll be like when they killed Wash.
Yeah.
They're like, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's there's good reason to believe that they will.
I mean, they've
just for the sake of like an amazing story.
They obviously.
But that's the thing, though. I don't think you should ever do it. I don't think you should ever do it. Just to go, oh, this will really freak out the audience. I'll never see this coming. There needs to be still a narratively justified reason to do it. And if there is, then do it. But don't do it just as a gimmick.
Just to do it. They've said all along that they know how the story ends. They've been saying since they announced episode 2 that like they already know how, you know, what happens next. So unless they've changed their minds, which I guess is their prerogative.
I mean, I'm sure they'll handle it in the right way. They've always treated Alex with such subtlety with how she works with Gordon. It's not like a very explicit romantic situation it's always like they're very, like, I think she probably only gives you like 2 hugs throughout the whole game. And there's really no direct dialogue about the relationship. It's just very light. And I mean, but it's at the same time, it's so strong. I don't know.
I just love that she's not like an animated help menu. You
well,
know
yes.
what I mean? Like, which is what so many sidekick characters sort of get relegated to, and I just have always liked that.
Play through the whole thing.
I actually was just thinking right now, like I have Crisis Warhead sitting here, and now I'm like, I just want to go play Half-Life.
It's that moment she puts her hand against the glass when you're traveling down the elevator.
Oh God, I know.
Oh, definitely, it's funny because like they build such a context for that because there's at least like 3 or 4 situations before you are going down an elevator and she's up there, and then when she finally does that, it's just like it connects those experiences. It's so cool.
All right.
Oh, gosh.
Should we end this love fest? Yeah.
This has been very affectionate and all.
Yeah.
You have any questions, Andy?
We do. We have this one question that I think will be a good time for, especially Gary, you to answer. So this guy's talking about how Jeff Green and Sean Elliott left 1UP, and they were kind of like big deals over there, and they're both going into the game development. I know, Gary, you've worked on some games, so maybe you can give this guy the answers he's searching for.
Hey, PC Gamer Podcast. This is Chris from Iowa. I was asking about the transition from games journalism to games development with the loss of Jeff Green and Sean Elliott over at 1UP. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on that matter. Really enjoy the podcast, and yeah, I'd like to hear that. So thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it's a pretty decent trend. I mean, I haven't been in the industry as long as other people have, but it seems like there's a good transition either from people that are journalists into game PR, which a lot of people consider the dark side of journalism, I guess, or directly into game development. I don't know if I can cite a percentage, but it seems...
Well, since you're fresh, Evan, I mean, let's get this on the table. Is your aspirations to get into the game development side of things?
That's a great question. I did start out as a computer science major my first year in college, I guess.
Okay.
But after finding out that I wasn't really good at math, I mean, I can't really say if it's my aspirations. Like, I'm so comfortable where I am. I'm so excited about just covering games, like being immersed in the industry and like knowing what's going on. I can't really say it's my aspiration, but like I have, you know, room within me for that to change and adapt naturally, I guess. But
cool.
I know like, many, many people who have transitioned from writing about games to the other side of the fence. It's been a fairly common thing for as long as I can remember, and I started in the industry 20 years ago. So there's always been a conduit there from one to the other. You know what it used to be, it's changed a little bit. It used to be that you would go from working on a magazine, you'd go into PR, because the company, you know, that was hiring you believed that because you knew all the people in the magazines that you would have some credibility or there'd be some, you know, some value to having you on the other side, and also because you understood the magazines and what it is that they want. But that's kind of burned out in recent years. People don't do that so much anymore. I actually know a couple of people who made the jump from journalism to PR and found it very unpalatable on the other side and didn't like it, and they came back over. But so what's kind of replaced it now is going into development directly. I mean, there are so many people I can think of that have done this and still, you know, have very successful careers at major developers. Obviously, you know, Jeff Green and Sean Elliott are just, you know, among the two most recent examples. Isn't Dan Morris also, our very own Dan Morris, a recent example of this?
I wouldn't say he's gone into development, but yeah, he has gone over to the gaming side of gaming, the game making side. Sure.
Yeah, and so I mean, you know, it's an easy. What makes it easy is that, you know, there's no real simple route into game development these days. I mean, you can take these college courses and you can make a mod and do various things like that. But what really matters is relationships. And the great thing about getting into journalism first, if design, you know, or development is your long-term goal, is that, you know, it's the position that puts you at the center of the industry. Everybody has to come and deal with you. You get to know, learn all the publishers and all the developers. And so if you decide that you want to get into that, you've got a lot of people you can reach out to. And obviously, you know, you also know when those openings are happening because you've got all those contacts. Doesn't necessarily mean that you're qualified. I've always said, you know, I wrote about games for many, many years, but I still to this day would not consider myself qualified to work in development as a designer or a producer. I don't know what it takes to make a game. I only know whether, you know, how to tell if it's good or bad when it's finished. But, you know, it's a very different skill set to figure out how to make a, you know, what makes a game good or bad when it's actually being made. It's easy to look at the result after the fact, much more difficult to identify the problems with a game while it's still, you know, in the sausage factory. So, but having said that, you know, a basic understanding of games is a really good foundation for it, and you can learn a lot on the job, and a lot of it is to do with personality and relationships, especially if you're going to be a producer or something like that. It's basically the same kind of team management skills that you have as the editor on a magazine. So there's a lot of overlap, and I think that's why it's been a very enduring conduit from one to the other. I can think of people that, you know, have been in, that started as a magazine journalist and are now been in development for more than 10 years and are doing very successful, and the door is obviously still open, so it's a good way in.
All right, good.
That's
some great perspective, because like I always kind of felt that there, like, game development is obviously a completely different animal. Just because you're experienced with games, you know what the conventions are, you know what works, what doesn't. At the end product, like you said, it doesn't seem like, I mean, even just programming, for example, that's such a completely different field, and knowing like what it takes, how long it takes to develop certain sections of a game, and what you can do realistically, what you can do with a small budget, big budget, like.
Well, what you won't find is people leaving journalism to go become programmers, because
yeah.
I mean, it's interesting. When I first was like a little spotty kid playing, you know, on my Commodore 64, and I wanted to get into the games industry, I wanted to be a game programmer. That was what I wanted to do first. And I went out and I bought you know, a book on machine code and a book on C++ and tried to teach myself. But my brain's just not wired that way. I'm good with words and sentences and creative problems, but I'm terrible with numbers and logic and things like that. So I was never going to be a programmer or anyone working on the technical side. And it was later when I realized that, you know, I was fairly good with words and I could write a little bit, that would be my way in, that I'd write about the games instead. And so generally, I think you will probably find that most people who are good at writing have got into that because that's what they're good at, as opposed to being good with logic and numbers. I imagine there are some people that are very, you know, kind of mentally ambidextrous, good with both. But the I don't know anyone from the journalism side that went into the technical side of development. They all became designers or producers.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And actually, I mean, along the same lines, I don't know if this is a good question or not, but I've always kind of had the struggle between myself. Like, do you, and Gary, like when you were here, would you guys consider yourselves gamers that happen to write, or just writers that happen to write about games?
I used to ask that question a lot because I thought it was a really interesting question. I used to say to people, do you consider yourself to be working in the magazine industry or the video game industry?
Right.
And, you know, and depending on their answer, I think that said a lot about, you know, how they approach their job. And I think the reality is, you know, you're a cog in the wheel of both. But I always, I mean, I went on to edit magazines that were outside of the video games industry. I edited magazines in sports and movies and did things outside of that. So I guess I was kind of more of a magazine guy than a game industry guy. But, you know, I didn't get into that job because I was interested in magazines. I got into it because I was interested in games. So it's a little bit of both.
Whereas I came at it the other way entirely.
But you were I was in magazines.
I was in magazines before. Yeah, I mean, I always played games, but you know, my publishing career started in. I mean, my career started in publishing.
So when they, did you get your first job on a games magazine because the idea were you into games and that was appealing to you, or did you get stuck on a games magazine and you're like, oh, I better get into
games? No. My first magazine, like when I left books and went to magazines, was actually for Maximum PC. It was for a hardware magazine. So I was already playing games, but then I had more impetus to play more games. And then from there, I actually started playing more. I realized I was more interested in games than in hardware. So from there, I went on to find a job on a games magazine. So
great, cool. Cool feedback. I think a lot of people, whenever I talk to like people that learned about that I'm working here, they're always like, "Wow, how do you even get into this profession?" They're so curious about it. So it's good feedback.
I don't know anybody.
Like Kristen, what do you think your next, let's say, you know, when your time one day far
my
in the
time
future,
is up. Run.
would it be more, you know, having spent a lot of time in magazines and a lot of time in the gaming world, would you find it more attractive to go work on another magazine that wasn't about games, but it was a subject that interested you, or would you be more interested in going work for a designer and like do something in the game world?
I don't know, 5 years ago, I would have said the latter. That was what was most important to me, was to stay in publishing. But I think things have changed a lot in the game industry in the last 5 years. And there are so many different options. Like you brought up Dan Morris, actually. There are so many different ways now to go and work in the gaming industry that don't just have to do with making a game. There's so many just like new opportunities to like figure out new directions to take games, or new ways to integrate games into people's lives. Like that has grown really interesting to me. And so I would say something like that. Like I love publishing and I love to write and edit, and that's very near and dear to my heart. But you know, I feel like if I had a job doing, if I wasn't doing those as a job, I could still do them on my own, which you can't really do in the game industry. So I would say probably at this point, I would want to remain in the game industry more than I would want to remain in publishing.
That's a really good point about like opportunities coming up that you would never even consider, because like, so this is a good example of how like I'm affiliated with PC Gamer all of a sudden, which is like still mind blowing to me in a lot of ways. And it's like this podcast has been going on for like 3 years now, maybe. And yeah, so that's only 3 years that there's been someone to do stuff that's in my field, which is, you know, like recording and editing audio and video and stuff like that, which is like, I'm hoping that I can be more into the video production side of maybe game press someday. But for now, this is just amazing to me in the first place.
Yeah, and I think those opportunities are growing by leaps and bounds. Like, look at how many opportunities there are now to do like television broadcasting related to games, or like you were saying,
exactly.
Audio. Like there's all kinds of ways to be working in the game industry that aren't specifically related to making games.
Sure. I mean, there's community management, there's PR, there's QA, there's all of the, you know, cutscene production and AV stuff. I mean,
I'll tell you what I would do if I could find a job that, that could, you know, pay for me. It's not like I have such advanced taste, but I would love, like, my degree is actually in communication and education, and I would love to find a job that somehow married like my education background and my love of gaming, because I feel like that's an untapped territory. Ooh. In general. So I'd love to find something that did that.
You could go back in time 15 years and write PC Gamer's education column.
Oh dear. So, what have you guys been playing over the past week? Andy Salisbury, how about yourself?
I've been getting my jollies from Crisis Warhead, because I haven't had a chance to actually play Crisis yet, and I saw it was released on Steam, so I decided to give that a whirl, and I'm actually enjoying it a lot so far. It's nice to have a good single-player first-person shooter to go through. And I've been getting a bit more time with the World of Warcraft Lich King beta lately, so only increasing how excited I am for that to be released.
Great. Andy Bauman.
Other than I haven't even gamed since I got back from Showdown. It's just been whirlwind of work and getting stuff done that I didn't get done because I was traveling and hanging out with you guys, which was badass. So TF2.
It was a pleasure. It was so funny. I wanted to mention this too. Like when we somehow forgot to bring Cat 5 cables to
them. Oh my god! Yeah. I guess I just thought that they had Cat 5 because this one land that we went to here just provided Cat 5 for everybody. So
kind of presumptuous of us. So if you're going to Showdown
Peoria, bring power strips and Cat 5s.
Yeah.
And the fact on the Showdown website does say that you should probably bring your keyboard to your hotel room every night, or you know, do that because people will take your keyboard.
Yeah,
that is so uncool. Are you serious?
Yeah, someone took my Lycosis.
Not okay.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
It's alright.
Somebody got the 5-finger discount on Andy Bauman's keyboard.
They'll probably game better. So you know, go for it.
That's very kind of you.
So sad.
All right. Anyway.
Yeah. How about you, Gary? What have you been playing?
I'm technically kind of between games right now, but I'm imminently going to be getting into Lego Batman. I'm very much looking forward to that. I love all the Lego games. I don't know, the formula is getting a little bit repetitive by now. You know, like the Indiana Jones games were basically exactly the Star Wars games with a different skin and a few tweaks, but you know, it's the same deal. The thing is, I just love it. I love those games. They're really, really fun to play two-player co-op. They did an outstanding job with both the Star Wars games and the Indiana Jones games. And so I'm going to be really interested to see what the Batman games are like. Came out this week, and I'm going to be getting into it this weekend. So that's going to be me for a while now, Lego Batman.
And Kristen, how about yourself?
Well, I'm sitting here with Crisis Warhead, like the DVD thing open on my desk. Like I was just getting ready to install it as soon as the podcast was over. But I don't know. Now you guys have got me all sort of thinking maybe a Half-Life 2 episode 2 replay.
Yeah, I'm thinking about playing that with the commentary
like,
on now that
back and playing the episodes.
Yeah.
No, I probably will play Crisis Warhead. I haven't had a chance to play much in the past week either because I haven't been here. I've been in transit. Because I've been doing tequila shots with my mom.
That's a good game,
at my sister's wedding, which is a pretty good game.
Sounds like it.
I think maybe Crisis Warhead. I want to give it a whirl.
It's cool. Pretty, I don't know, it's not like best game ever, but it's enjoyable. I'm enjoying it so far.
And that's sort of what, Logan reviewed it in our issue that's going to the press right now. And I think that's pretty much how he assessed it as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I still want to give it a whirl. Yep.
Yeah, I've been playing a little bit of Warhead 2, probably just a couple hours of it. I've also been playing TF2 pretty much every day. And in addition to that, there's a 2D indie version of Team Fortress 2 that somebody made. It's called Gang Garrison, which is sort of like a synonym for Team Fortress.
That's awesome.
It's really cool. It through smoke or whatever.
Yeah, I'll post a link on our... But I'll post a link to it on the podcast comments thread. It's like a side-scrolling multiplayer only. Like, you have to legitimately connect to a server. And it's sort of like, I mean, it's 2D Team Fortress, like, kind of platformer style. And you move with WSAD, and you click. And it's worth it alone just for, like, the chiptune version of the game's theme song that you hear.
That's really fun.
Yeah, everybody needs to look at it.
It's really neat. All right, well, we've reached the caboose of today's podcast train, but in the weekly absence... Oh, no.
So good!
Thanks, Andy.
You're a wordsmith. Right.
But in the weekly absence of our chorus of computer experts, we welcome your vocal contributions for upcoming episodes. Send your questions to us in MP3 format to pcgamerpodcast@gmail.com, or you can just call us toll-free at 877-404-LEET... extension 724, and record your question there, and please keep it light on the language and brief. Oh, so funny.
What's with the laughing in the background?
Caboose.
It's a pretty easy analogy. I don't
you
know
slayed him, man.
It's just so rare to hear the word caboose.
It's kind of saucy, it's kind of a funny word.
The caboose of our podcast train. That's so good.
And now you're derailing the podcast.
Wow.
Oh, my word.
All right. Well, I'll try and continue that analogy next week. Locomotion or something. I don't know.
Oh, my God.
I'm sorry.
Mute yourself, son.
I can't stop.
As a reminder, we'd also invite you to check out our final Showdown LAN event this weekend in Peoria, starting September 26th, which is tomorrow, Friday, running through Sunday the 28th. You can also join our League of Extraordinary Publications by subscribing to PC Gamer Magazine. Just head on over to pcgamer.com/subscribe. For the PC Gamer Podcast crew, this is Evan Lottie saying thanks for listening, and we're looking forward to circling our Sonic wagons again next week. Wow, just mute yourself at this point.
Do you have this stuff written down, or is it just all coming out of your head?
Oh, no, it's a script, yeah.
Okay, good. Good to know.
Yeah, I'm not that inclined.
It's just the analogy, it's just like a non-stop train of analogies. I love it.
I'm glad. Yeah, what was the one I did for the first one? It was about, like, we've reached the end of this podcast Snowy Slope, and then I mentioned Ski Free.
Oh yeah, and then that's when I started freaking out, because that game's awesome.
Love Ski Free. We should do...
I'm in tears.
I think this has to be the new rule. There has to be an analogy at the end of every...
That's a good rule.
Very elaborate and like... Yeah.
I like it.
We're at the black hole of our Large Hadron Collider.
Oh, damn it. You should have saved that one. Now we can't
don't
even use it.
Don't waste them all. Save it for next week.
Yeah. Oh,
I just blew fantastic out my microphone. Awesome.
Oh, man.
Oh, my God. I'm sorry. I just lost it at the end.
I'm sure it will come as no surprise to you that my sister is as sort of non... What is that?
What the f*** is that?
Sorry, I was putting the sandwich away.
My mom, like, who's not really a big drinker and kind of a small person to begin with, like, looked at me and she was like, come on, get your aunts. Like, let's all go do a tequila shot. I was like, okay. Whoa. So we all went up to the little bar and Cappy, the bartender, was like handing us each a shot glass. And so we each had one. And then he turned to my mom and he was like, oh no, I'm out of shot glasses. And my mom just like scans the table where all the liquor is and grabs this ladle that had been in the sangria.
Wow.
It was like, I'll just use this.
Your family sounds awesome.